Look, the next 9 months or so, and maybe more than that, depending on the coup schedule, they're gonna suck. You're gonna be getting emails with insane subject lines like, "Hello, John, it's Chuck Schumer." "Donald Trump is right behind you with a knife." You're gonna get inundated with robocalls and push polls and real polls, and people are gonna tell you to rock the vote and be the vote and vote the vote. And it's all going to make you feel like Tuesday, November 5th is the only day that matters. Mm-hmm. And that day does matter. But man, November 6th ain't nothing to sneeze at, or November 7th. If your guy loses, bad things might happen, but the country is not over. And if your guy wins, the country is in no way saved. I've learned one thing over these last 9 years, and I was glib at best and probably dismissive at worst about this. The work of making this world resemble one that you would prefer to live in is a lunch pail job, day in and day out, where thousands of committed, anonymous, smart, and dedicated people bang on closed doors and pick up those that are fallen and grind away on issues till they get a positive result. And even then have to stay on to make sure that result holds.
Mm-hmm.
So the good news is, I'm not saying you don't have to worry about who wins the election. I'm saying you have to worry about every day before it and every day after. Forever.
Oh, great. I didn't sign up for forever.
Oh, what? On the plus side, I am told that at some point, the sun will run out of hydrogen.
So there's that to look forward to. Some good news, right?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Oh, man, that's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. Stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. And yeah, it's one of those days where I think we got just too much to cover. No time to read off the list of affiliates.
But we love you anyway.
We do. Welcome back to the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says everyone I know, from bradblog.com, now celebrating 20 years of troublemaking and muckraking, thanks to you. All right, we've got, as I said, a lot to try to get to today, but really, none more important for now, I think, than this, at least for today. You know, as I recall, several weeks back when the news was announced, Desi, you may remember this, I asked our friends Digby and Driftglass on one of our special coverage shows.
Yep.
I think it was following one of the pretend GOP presidential debates. What the most important news of that day was. What happened in that debate the night before, or the new news that day that Jon Stewart would be returning to host The Daily Show on Comedy Central throughout this election year. And don't laugh, Desi Doyen, because I was not actually kidding at the time.
True.
I noted back when he was on the air every night years ago, and he had left the show just before Donald Trump announced his candidacy for the president back in 2015, the first time. That Jon Stewart really did set the tone for discussion of a lot of our politics and issues in this country. And I believe he was far more influential than people might believe or that people might now remember looking back. In fact, as I had noted to Digby and Driftglass, I'm not sure if Donald Trump would have ultimately won the election back in 2016 had Jon Stewart been on the air at the time. In any event, on Monday night, this week, Jon Stewart, who hosted The Daily Show for, I think, about 16 years before leaving the show for 9 years, well, he finally returned as host of the show, if only on Monday nights. But, you know, small complaint. And man, was I reminded when watching that show last night, Desi Doyen, man, is he good at it. He is good at that show.
Yes, he is definitely is, and he has not missed a beat. He is as sharp as ever, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, even after 9 years, it was like, other than looking a lot older.
True, as we all do.
It was as if he had never left the show. I mean, he just boom picked up right where he was. So, what did you think of his return? You were impressed.
I was very impressed. I mean, I really appreciate that he has a very incisive and clear way of explaining and bringing in some insightful perspective onto all of these issues. Like you say, setting the tone for the discussion. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, we need to talk about this. I very much appreciate that. Now, I still think he's prone to a bit too much both sidesing, but you know, I don't love everything he says and does, but I think that he does a really good job of framing how many Americans experience politics.
And I know that some Democrats out there are already sort of freaking out because, oh, Jon Stewart was tough on Joe Biden, specifically on his age and the way his supporters have been sort of tiptoeing around that, despite how obvious it is that Joe Biden is, as it turns out, really old. And so, by the way, is Donald Trump, as Stewart also noted.
One thing we know for certain is this. We have two candidates who are chronologically outside the norm of anyone who has run for the presidency in this country, in the history of this country. They are the oldest people ever to run for president, breaking by only 4 years the record that they set the last time they ran.
But Evie's right. But here's the thing. As I mentioned, you know, in relation to something else, I think yesterday, there is no way through that fact, but through it. Joe Biden is old. He also, by the way, is remarkably effective as president. The most effective, in fact, in my lifetime. That, like his age, is just a fact. The other thing that is just a fact that I think Democrats need to come to terms with, barring any surprises, Joe Biden is going to be the party's candidate again for president this year. Get used to it, suck it up, and come to terms with it. Is he old? Yes. Is he effective? Yes. Might he be more effective if he was younger? In truth, not relevant. But okay, worth discussing. At least worth hashing out and having that conversation. Is he perfect, by the way? No, not even close. Do I support all of his policies? No, I do not. But again, that's beside the point. I know some Democrats out there were not happy with Stewart spending so much time on Biden's age in particular. Well, too bad, because that is what is on everybody's mind, for good or ill. And I believe that his presence, Jon Stewart's, on The Daily Show, dealing with that issue head on and honestly, well, I think it's a conversation that Democrats need to have amongst themselves, if nothing else. And at this point, I think they need to have it sooner rather than later so that they can come to terms with it. To help them come to terms with the facts that you wish maybe Joe Biden wasn't the nominee to go against Donald Trump this year. Okay, don't care. He is going to be the nominee. So how are you going to deal with that? In the choice between too old and too wildly dangerous, which choice are you going to make? Because there is no time like right now to start coming to terms with that very question. And by the way, time for the media to start dealing with that question honestly as well. Honestly, not salaciously or dishonestly, or allowing a disingenuous and purposely misleading special counsel's report from a Trump-appointed prosecutor to deceitfully set the agenda over much more important news. Or the fact that the special counsel's report determined that there was no basis for bringing charges against Joe Biden, end of special counsel's report, period, or at least it should have been if the media were dealing with this honestly.
The headline should have been Biden exonerated.
but I will try to get to that a little bit later. Jon Stewart is brilliant. His return to The Daily Show will be good for the nation. And by the way, I believe that is true, even if you or I or anyone else may not always agree with absolutely everything he has to say. Mm-hmm. His framing of the issues, the discussion is what matters. And he is also damned good at the job. And he has not, as you said, Des, he has not lost a step. To be frank, other than on his, you know, aging face, because people get old. All right. Speaking of what is making me old today, let's get to some of the today's news, shall we? We'll start easy with this. In the U.S. Northeast, we go to air today, as some 50 million people are currently under weather alerts and nearly 1,500 flights are canceled as a nor'easter slams the region, with a bunch of snow expected to fall for the first time out there, really, in a couple of years in many places. And it seems only fair, we had it out here on the West Coast for days last week.
True.
Anyway, that's not just a weather or climate story in this particular instance, even if it might be both. But today, that story of what's going on with the weather in the Northeast is actually also a political story. Why? Well, as you may recall, last week, around this time, the Republican-led U.S. House saw a massive fail for themselves when, while holding a floor vote in hopes of passing articles of revenge impeachment against a sitting cabinet member for the first time in U.S. history, they actually failed. The vote failed. Apparently, they couldn't count votes in advance, or at least they were surprised when Democratic Congressman Al Green, who had been in the hospital for emergency surgery, when the GOP saw that and decided, well, let's quickly hold a vote. Well, Al Green showed up in his hospital scrubs to vote against impeachment of Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas in a chaotic, hectic, and embarrassing vote for the Republicans. Mayorkas is being impeached for, or at least they're attempting to impeach him for, not high crimes or misdemeanors as required by the Constitution, but because Republicans have not been able to figure out how to impeach Joe Biden. And they decided to pretend that they don't like the Biden administration's border policies, thinking that will help them get elected. So they're going to impeach the DHS secretary due to a purported policy dispute, I guess. I say purported because Republicans have already proven that, you know, given everything that they claim they wanted at the border, and given everything that they claim they wanted at the border in a bargain with Senate Democrats, well, Republicans rejected that bipartisan proposal in the Senate because Donald Trump told them he did not want them to solve this problem, this existential problem, this invasion of our nation. He didn't want that because, well, then he wouldn't have anything to run on this year. And Republicans complied. In any event, on Tuesday, it is expected that House Republicans were going to try again to pass articles of impeachment against Mayorkas. But as AP notes, having failed last week, House Republicans are determined to try again Tuesday, but it is not at all certain that the do-over vote will produce a better tally after last week's politically embarrassing setback. The evening vote is expected to be tight, with Speaker Mike Johnson's threadbare GOP majority unable to handle many defectors or absences in the face of staunch Democratic opposition to impeaching Mayorkas, the first cabinet secretary facing charges in nearly 150 years, and the only one to actually be in office when doing so, by the way. Despite the expected arrival of Republican Majority Leader Steve Scalise, who will bolster the GOP numbers after he was away from Washington for cancer care, even one other missing or weather-delayed lawmaker could imperil the impeachment vote. That's right. The numbers are so narrow in the U.S. House and the Republican majority so slight that one member unable to make it to the vote due to that nor'easter now hanging over 50 million people's heads out there in the Northeast, well, that could prevent Johnson from getting the bare majority a second time that he would need in the GOP's revenge impeachment quest. But no big deal, right? They'll get their majority eventually. Maybe, but maybe not. Because, as AP also notes, which probably explains the rush to get this done as soon as possible, whether they have the votes or not, if the vote pushes later into the week because someone can't make it, well, the outcome of Tuesday's special election for the U.S. House in New York to replace ousted Congressman George Santos could tip the balance further against Republicans and their ability to get a majority to vote in favor of this faux impeachment, which, if it's ultimately adopted in the Republican-led U.S. House, well, may never even be taken up for a trial in the Democratic-led U.S. Senate, much less get the two-thirds vote that would be required in the upper chamber to actually remove Mayorkas from office. The GOP effort to impeach Mayorkas over border security has taken on an air of political desperation, as AP reports it. That's them, not me.
Wow, AP saying desperation.
As Republicans try to make good on their priorities after last week's mishap and after Republicans rejected a bipartisan Senate border security package. For the record, never before has a sitting cabinet member been impeached, and it was nearly 150 years ago that the House voted to impeach the only other one, President Ulysses S. Grant's Secretary of War, William Belknap, over a kickback scheme in government contracts. So that was an actual high crime and misdemeanor, but Belknap actually resigned just moments before the vote. So this vote this week, if it happens against Mayorkas, is as destined to fail in the Senate, no matter what, and or in the House, as it may be, it would be an historic first for a sitting member of the presidential cabinet. As to that election in New York on Long Island on Tuesday, not sure how the weather will have affected it, but voters in the increasingly Republican-leaning 3rd Congressional District in New York and in this part of Nassau County, they are voting to fill the seat left vacated by the disgraced, expelled Republican con artist George Santos. Conservative Democrat Tom Suozzi is facing off against kind of loony and very MAGA Republican local councilwoman Mazie Pilip, or Pilip, I don't know, for the seat in the very narrowly divided U.S. House. We will have full results as they are known on tomorrow's broadcast, and what I believe is the last super special election for the U.S. House before this year's general elections in November. So you see how everything sort of ties together in the Northeast today?
Oh, yeah.
In other news out of Congress at this hour, after an all-night session with the weather setting in, the U.S. Senate overcame a Republican filibuster to finally pass a foreign aid bill very early on Tuesday morning that includes additional support for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The bill does not, at Donald Trump's insistence, include the mass border package that was hammered out between Republicans and Democrats because the Republicans insisted that any aid package for Ukraine must also include massive funding for far-right border initiatives. And yet, once a deal was hammered out, Trump told them he didn't want to solve this supposedly existential crisis, this so-called invasion at our border, because he needed it for an election issue. So Republicans then insisted, they had a new insistence to make here, that any aid package for Ukraine must not include massive funding for the far-right border initiatives that Republicans had pretended to insist upon previously. So for the record, failure of the inclusion of those new border security measures in the bill, that also means the Department of Homeland Security, yes, headed by Alejandro Mayorkas, may soon run out of the funds needed to hire new agents, which means that could be fewer arrests and detentions and deportations as funding from Congress for DHS runs out. Well, you better impeach the head of DHS in that case. But the $95 billion national security aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan did finally pass in the Senate overnight with, vote vets said, they're the largest progressive organization for veterans and families in the nation, representing over 1.5 million members. They noted that they were quick to point out on Twitter today, quote, "To be clear, 26 Republicans voted to block aid to Ukraine. They want to hand Putin a win and betray an American ally." That comes from the largest progressive vet organization in the nation. Senate passage, nonetheless, was a significant step forward after months of delay centered on whether tough border security measures would be part of the package until Republicans decided they wouldn't be. But despite passage in the Senate, over on the House side, again, once again, under pressure from Trump, Speaker Mike Johnson has withered and is vowing to not let that Senate bill even come up for a vote on the floor. With millions in our democratic sovereign ally of Ukraine still under siege and running out of ammo, under siege by the continuing nearly two-year-old invasion now by Putin's imperialist fascist Russia, and democracy in Europe itself hanging in the balance. So that emergency aid bill now faces an uncertain fate in the GOP-controlled House as of Tuesday. And speaking of the twice-impeached, four-time criminally indicted, failed one-term president, Donald Trump, now apparently pulling all of the strings for the Republicans in Congress, well, he's also pulling those strings everywhere else. Donald Trump on Monday night announced that he will support North Carolina GOP Chair Michael Whatley to succeed Ronna Romney McDaniel as the leader of the Republican National Committee. His endorsement of Whatley after pushing out Ronna formally cements his push to see a change at the top of the committee after weeks of reports that he had grown frustrated with McDaniel, according to Politico. But in addition to the Whatley nod, they know Trump will also support Laura Trump, his own daughter-in-law, to serve as the RNC's co-chair.
Who has no experience as far as I know, but hey, it's always good to have a family member on the inside.
And we don't live in a banana republic at all, do
no.
we?
No.
What's the old saying? That the Republican Party now is a failed nation and Donald Trump is its warlord? Sounds about right, especially here. Laura is married to Eric Trump, Donald's son, who pretends to run the Trump Organization when Trump is serving as president. So his son runs his company, and his daughter-in-law runs the Republican Party, and his daughter and son-in-law worked as senior advisors in the White House before receiving about $2 billion from the Saudi regime as a parting gift upon leaving office. No, not banana republic at all. Now, the endorsement does not mean for sure that either Whatley or Laura Trump will automatically be given those posts, notes Politico. The committee must hold a vote. The executive committee must hold a vote among its members should McDaniel step down. By the way, she has not actually stepped down yet. She's expected to do so after the South Carolina primary on February 24, but notes Politico, that'll likely be a formality as the party members are almost certain to support whichever Nepo babies he wants running his Republican National Committee. So there you go. Also, his campaign manager will also be the chief operating officer of the RNC. He'll be holding that job at the same time that he's the campaign manager. So his daughter-in-law and his campaign manager will now be running the RNC, as announced, before the current chair has even left. And, oh, by the way, while the GOP presidential primary is still underway. Again, Nikki Haley is still in the race. Imagine how Trump and Republicans, and even many on the left, correctly in this case, would be screaming about how the election was rigged had this sort of thing happened for the Democratic candidate in the Democratic Party who was running for the nomination. Actually, you don't have to imagine it. That's exactly what Trump did in 2016 after some hacked emails suggested that Hillary Clinton was actually working closely to raise money for the DNC back then. But, you know, our media covered the two parties very differently. That was very much on display last week when a Trump-appointed prosecutor released his special counsel report on the classified documents that Joe Biden's staff actually discovered that he had retained after previously leaving office as vice president. And boy, howdy, did the media present a contrast in how that matter, finding no charges to be brought, no charges being warranted, versus the way that they covered special counsel reports for Donald Trump, like the one from special counsel Robert Mueller, finding at least 10 instances of criminal obstruction for the then sitting president. You ever notice when there's a sitting Democratic president that a Republican special prosecutor must be named for the probe for it to be seen as legitimate? While on the other hand, when the sitting president is a Republican, in that case, for that probe to be seen as legit, a Republican special prosecutor must also be named. Yep, that's how it works, apparently. Anyway, some thoughts on what Republican special prosecutor Robert Hur discovered about Democratic President Joe Biden. That is next on the broadcast, plus our latest Green News report, all ahead today on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you, who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
When trumpets were mellow and every gal only had one fellow,
I bet no one else in the media started their coverage of Special Counsel Robert Hur's report with that song. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, I had actually hoped to get to this on Monday, but there was just too much all at once. But one of the reasons that we are in the mess that we are in is because, as I've mentioned once or twice over the years, our mainstream corporate media is terrible and continues to be terrible after all of these years. So let me try to cover this story. This story actually broke last Thursday night, just after we got off air. Let me try to cover it closer to the way it should have been covered by our nation's very well-paid corporate media. Do I sound jealous? Yes, I am. Anyway, separate issue. On Thursday, just after the corrupted, packed, and far-right majority on the U.S. Supreme Court suggested during oral argument that they were prepared to ignore all of their pretend claims about being constitutional conservatives who strictly follow the text of the Constitution and the intent of its framers by ignoring the insurrectionist disqualification clause in the Constitution, that's the 14th Amendment, Section 3, in order to allow Donald Trump to run for office again, despite being found to have been an insurrectionist by both courts and bipartisan majorities of both chambers of Congress. After that, a former Trump-appointed DOJ prosecutor released a nearly 400-page report. Sounds bad. Finding no evidence to bring criminal charges against President Biden for having held on to a few pages of classified documents after he left the vice presidency in 2017.
In other words, he exonerated Biden.
As Special Counsel Robert Hur noted in his report, for those who bothered to actually read beyond the misleading headlines from the corporate media, quote, there is no record of the Department of Justice prosecuting a former president or vice president for mishandling classified documents from his own administration. The exception is former President Trump. It is not our role to assess the criminal charges pending against Mr. Trump, but several material distinctions between Mr. Trump's case, for which, by the way, he has been charged with, I believe it's 40 felonies. The distinctions between Trump's case and Mr. Biden's case are clear. Unlike the evidence involving Mr. Biden, the allegations set forth in the indictment of Mr. Trump, if proven, would present serious aggravating facts. Most notably, after being given multiple chances to return classified documents and avoid prosecution, Mr. Trump allegedly did the opposite. According to the indictment, he not only refused to return the documents for many months, but he also obstructed justice by enlisting others to destroy evidence and then to lie about it. In contrast, Mr. Biden turned in classified documents to the National Archives, and the Department of Justice consented to the search of multiple locations, including his homes. He sat for hours for a voluntary interview, and in other ways, cooperated with the investigation. And yes, that should be that. But of course, what the media chose to focus on instead is dozens and in dozens and dozens of stories. Was the non-medical doctor, prosecutor Robert Herr, and his contention that one of the reasons he could not bring charges against Biden was because a jury would see him, as Herr's office did during their hours of interviews with him, as, quote, as a sympathetic, well-meaning, elderly man with poor memory.
Now, to be clear, Herr is speculating here what a jury might think. That's not an actual diagnosis of any kind.
Of course, that one phrase, frankly, became the entire story. And the corporate mainstream media went into a frenzy, and the right-wing social media outlets like Twitter that play along with them, well, they were all off and running. Never mind what the report actually found in its hundreds of pages, because who actually bothers to read that? They just read the headlines. What? Well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. So, Andrew Weissman and Ryan Goodman, both former DOJ prosecutors, wrote over at Just Security after actually reading the nearly 400-page report, the special counsel Robert Herr report has been grossly mischaracterized by the press, they wrote. Indeed, the report on page 6 notes that there are, quote, innocent explanations that Herr, quote, cannot refute. What the report actually says is there is insufficient evidence of criminality, innocent explanations for the conduct, and affirmative evidence that Biden did not willfully withhold classified documents. Unlike the tens of thousands of pages, by the way, that Donald Trump not only took but then withheld and hid and lied about over and over and over for a year and a half after leaving office, here, there's no evidence at all of criminality. Herr, they note, Weissman and Goodman note, could have represented his actual findings on page 1 of his executive summary. He could have said, quote, we have concluded that there is not a prosecutable case against Joe Biden, although there was a basis to open the investigation based on the fact that classified documents were found in Biden's home and office space. That is insufficient to establish a crime was committed. The illegal retention or dissemination of national defense information requires that he knew of the existence of such documents and that he knew they contained national defense information. It is not a crime without those additional elements. That is what Robert Herr could have put up at the top, but instead he put something about old Sleepy Joe and his bad memory or something. But so what did the actual Herr report actually say that it found? And again, apparently he had to go hunting for this. The Hur report states, this is on page 6, so really no excuse for media not to notice this, quote, in addition to this shortage of evidence, there are other innocent explanations for the documents that we cannot refute. That's on page 6. Weissman and Goodman also note the lack of evidence of knowledge that some of this information was classified at all. Hur said on page 221, we cannot prove that he knew the memo was classified when he left office. We cannot prove that retaining the memo, he willfully retained national defense information. Again, you have to willfully retain national defense information to be brought to have charges brought against you like they were brought against Donald Trump under the Espionage Act.
But he waited until 200 pages to say that.
These facts do not support a conclusion that Mr. Biden willfully retained the marked classified documents in these binders. That's on page 332 and 333. Mr. Biden told us in his interview that he does not recognize the marking confidential as a classification marking. To him, the marking means the document should be held in confidence, but not necessarily that it is classified. Although confidential is, in fact, a category of classified information, we would likely be unable to refute Mr. Biden's claim that he did not know this. That is on page 221. Now, our friend Marcy Wheeler over at Empty Wheel also noted that Hur explains regarding some of the theoretically classified documents from Biden's days back in the Senate. He had some of those. Quote, some of the documents are marked confidential. While that is valid marking for classified information, the term confidential is also used in other contexts not involving classified information. Senate staffers could have understood these to be internal committee documents or simply sensitive documents created by authors who wanted to limit the number of people who viewed them. Before they were subsequently moved along with the then new vice president's belongings out of his longtime Senate office, where they were eventually discovered and, yes, quickly returned to the government. On page 177, we cannot prove that Mr. Biden retained these classified documents willfully. On page 326, evidence does not suggest either that Mr. Biden retained the classified documents inside them willfully or that the documents contain national defense information. Again, all the stuff that would be needed to bring any kind of charges for any kind of case under the Espionage Act, the way Donald Trump has been charged with 40 violations of that act. On page 329, quote, for each of the marked classified documents found in Mr. Biden's notebooks, we cannot prove that Mr. Biden knew about or intended to keep the document after he was vice president, or we cannot prove the document contains national defense information, or both. So his notebooks, as you heard Robert Hur refer to them there, the bulk of the so-called classified information were in Biden's own notes taken during his vice presidency. Quote, in Mr. Biden's interview with our office, he explained that he took his notebook with him after his vice presidency because, quote, they are mine. And explained that, quote, every president before me has done the same exact thing, unquote. He also specifically referenced President Reagan, who, after leaving office, kept handwritten diaries containing classified information at his private home. In later written answers, Mr. Biden wrote that, quote, like presidents and vice presidents before me, I understand that these notes are my personal property. Now, Marcy Wheeler wrote about these personal notes that Robert Hur continuously describes as notebooks. In fact, they are diaries, just like Ronald Reagan's diaries. Marcy writes, it's Hur's analysis of Biden's diaries that I find the most interesting and troubling. Hur's approach to these diaries is one of the most obvious flags of political bias in a report full of them. Take his use of language. The word diaries appears 103 times in the report. In about five of those instances, her quotes the people around Biden, referring to these notebooks as diaries. Two instances discuss the language in the Presidential Records Act, treating diaries as personal records, exempt from the Presidential Records Act. Maybe 10 or so of these references in a section where her envisions that Biden would describe these as diaries, as a defense, but the word is always put into Biden's mouth. Her, instead, when he describes these books, calls them notebooks, not diaries, for some reason. Quote from the report, Mr. Biden will likely say he never believed his notebooks, which he thought of as his personal diaries, fell within that arrangement. He treated the notebooks markedly differently from the rest of his notes and other presidential records throughout his vice presidency, for example, allowing staff to store and review his note cards, but not his notebooks. This treatment, he will argue, and the extremely personal content of some of the notebooks show that he considered them to be his personal property. Mr. Biden's notebooks included gut-wrenching passages about his son's death and other highly personal material. That's right. Robert Herr rifled through Joe Biden's personal diaries, where he talked about the death of his son and much more personal material. But Robert Herr, he homogenizes all of that by, oh, you know, it's fine. It's just, these are notebooks of Biden's. His claim that he believed he did not need to send what he considered to be his personal diary to be stored at a government facility will likely appeal to some jurors, I should say so. We expect Mr. Biden also to contend that the presence of classified information in what he viewed as his diary, because it was his diary, did not change his thinking. As a member of the exclusive club of former presidents, vice presidents, Mr. Biden will claim that he knew such officials kept diaries. And he knew or expected that those diaries, like Mr. Reagan's, contained classified information. He also understood that former presidents, vice presidents, took their diaries home upon leaving office without being investigated or prosecuted for it. So that's what all of this hubbub is about, by the way. Not all of it, but the bulk of it is about handwritten notes kept by Joe Biden while serving as vice president in his own diaries. Marcy goes on to note the overwhelming bulk of those 85 or so uses of the word diaries actually describe Ronald Reagan's diaries, or in two other cases, other presidents' diaries. So you can describe them as diaries if they're Ronald Reagan's, but if they're Joe Biden's, they're notebooks. By contrast, she notes there are 461 uses of the word notebook. In Herr's report, that's the word that Herr uses to refer to what he quotes people around Biden calling the president's diaries. Reagan had diaries, and as a result, when DOJ discovered them, they remained untouched. Biden has notebooks, and by calling these notebooks, Herr permitted himself to do with Biden's most private thoughts what DOJ did not do with Reagan's, reviewed all of them. So if that doesn't tell you that this was a hit job, plain and simple, I don't know what will. And by the way, that hit job worked, because the mainstream corporate media didn't, you know, wait around to actually read these things back on, you know, page 323 of the report. They just, you know, ran to a microphone and said, Robert Herr called Joe Biden old. Is he too old to be the president? Nobody apparently reads the full report. Well, Marcy Wheeler does. You know, they just read what is told to them about these reports on, you know, social media and headlines. And in the case of the media, well, they just grab onto Herr's most salacious references to Joe Biden's memory. And boy, did they run with that. Sadly, not just the right-wing Fox News media, but the supposedly real media outlets. Judd Legum of Popular Information put together a Twitter thread on this. He notes, Robert Herr is a lawyer, not a doctor. Hers legal opinion is that criminal charges against Biden are not warranted. Hers medical opinion is that Biden has, quote, diminished faculties. But the media covered Hers amateur medical diagnosis as a political crisis for Joe Biden. Although Her is completely unqualified to make a judgment about Biden's mental health, major outlets produced an avalanche of coverage. In the 4 days following Her's report, Legum notes, Washington Post wrote 33 stories about Biden's mental fitness in 4 days. New York Times wrote 30. Wall Street Journal wrote 18. The New York Times described the Her report as, quote, a political disaster. Quote, a political nightmare, quote, a new political crisis, and quote, a political mess. And that's just what was included in purportedly objective news reports in those outlets. Never mind the editorials and the columns. It's a disaster. Well, it didn't sound like a disaster to me when we actually read what was in the actual report, did it? New York Times columnists with no medical credentials said Biden was sliding, quote, into dementia. The New York Times editorial board described the report ominously as, quote, a dark moment for Mr. Biden's presidency. Well, I guess that's that darn liberal media for you. On February 9, a New York Times health reporter published, quote, memory loss requires careful diagnosis. Scientists say it noted Her's judgment, quote, were not based on science and that his methods bore no resemblance to those that doctors use. Those facts were omitted from the other 29 stories published by New York Times in the 4 days following Her's report. Washington Post produced even more coverage, 33 stories. The articles described Her's report as a devastating, quote, devastating picture of Biden's mental agility, quote, a devastating portrait of an 81-year-old president, and quote, damning. The Washington Post interviewed several memory experts. They noted that the cognitive abilities of Biden and Trump can't be evaluated based on anecdotal memory lapses, but they noted that memory lapses at any age are surprisingly normal and for most people aren't a sign of mental decline. But only one of those 33 stories noted that Her's opinions about Biden were, in fact, baseless. So one report said, you can't go by, he has memory lapses, but people who are young have memory lapses. You may notice I have them all the time on this show. So only one of those 33 stories in the Post mentioned that, and that Her's opinions about Biden's memory were baseless. That piece was written by health reporters. It noted that, quote, the cognitive abilities of Biden can't be evaluated based on anecdotal memory lapses. The Wall Street Journal produced a flood of incendiary column headlines like Special Counsel Biden too forgetful to prosecute, a tipping point on Biden's decline. Trump, by the way, also a senior citizen, has had several public memory lapses and mix-ups of late. He called Viktor Orban, who was actually the leader of Hungary, he called him the leader of Turkey. He said that Orban shared a border with Russia, which is not true, of Hungary or Turkey. He warned that America is on the verge of World War II. He claimed he defeated Barack Obama in the 2016 election instead of Hillary Clinton. But of course, Trump's memory lapses get far less coverage. The most widely covered was his mix-up of Nikki Haley and Nancy Pelosi. That incident was mentioned by the New York Times just 4 times. The Washington Post 9 times. The Wall Street Journal brought it up 2x. In addition to the volume of coverage, the nature of the Trump coverage is much different. Legum notes, it was not described by any of the papers as a serious political problem for Trump, but for some reason it's a problem for Biden. Most simply highlighted the fact that Nikki Haley was using that incident to attack Trump. On February 10, the New York Times explored why voters seem so much more worried about Biden than Trump, even though they are around the same age. The article says the disparate treatment by voters reflects, quote, profound differences in how they are perceived by the American public. The piece did not mention that the perceptions of the two men by the public are shaped by media coverage. Look, discussing the fact that Biden is old is totally a fair game, as John Stewart made clear, and as we discussed in the previous block. It is totally fair game. He is old. It is okay to have concerns about his age. But what the hell is it doing in a prosecutor's report on whether crimes were committed or not, feeding this hungry leviathan that is our irresponsible corporate mainstream media, who are not serving the public, who are not serving the electorate, but who apparently are serving themselves and trying to get as many hits as they can to their websites? It's pathetic, and it's killing our country, and it needs to be called out, and we'll do our best to continue to do so. Quick break, and we're back with Green News Report right after this. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Okay, Desi Doyen, I've already aged about a month just over the past hour of this show, so handing it over to you for our latest Green News Report.
Nice ride.
It's the real deal. 100% electric.
Super Bowl EV ads mark the slow but persistent cultural shift in the transition from fossil fuels. Oil and gas industry spending big to get Trump into the White House. Plus,
it's really about the defense of science.
Jury sides with climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann in defamatory right-wing smear campaign.
All of those smear campaigns and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It is not okay to make false and defamatory accusations against scientists as part of an ideologically driven agenda to discredit science that might be inconvenient to your political views.
Well, there goes Michael Mann again, putting even more people out of work. Like right-wing propagandists don't deserve to have a job. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, after we went through it out here a week or so ago with some horrific weather, now apparently it's their turn up in the Northeast.
Yes, please be safe out there.
They're getting walloped today. What do you have for us, Des?
Well, first, the oil and gas industry is giving millions to Republican Party frontrunner, disgraced former President Donald Trump.
You don't say.
According to an analysis of campaign donor data by Bloomberg News, the oil and gas sector is one of Trump's biggest funders in the 2024 election cycle and a critical source of campaign cash for him, giving Trump nearly $8 million. In the same period, the industry gave President Biden just over $600,000.
Of course.
It's a big snub for Biden's record fossil fuel production and profits during his term. Bloomberg notes Trump has also pledged to dismantle critical environmental pollution and climate regulations and expand the fossil fuel industry, the primary driver of man-made climate change.
Mm-hmm.
In related news, the Tampa Bay Times reports that Florida's Republican-controlled state legislature is now working on a bill that would delete nearly all references to climate change in state law. The bill would also weaken regulations on natural gas pipelines and block local government control over the location of natural gas storage facilities.
Well, you know, if you don't say the words climate change, climate change can't exist.
It would also kill off a provision that had required state agencies and local governments to purchase fuel-efficient vehicles. One thing the legislature is not focusing on, solutions to Florida's property insurance crisis, as premiums skyrocket and insurers leave the state because of the surge in climate-intensified extreme weather disasters.
Yeah, but if you don't say climate change, you know, there's really no problem here.
In other news, Super Bowl ads tend to reflect some of the cultural zeitgeist in the U.S. In Sunday's big game, the first held in a stadium using 100% renewable energy.
Cool.
All electric vehicle models continued the growing trend of dominating the automotive ad category more than conventional gas vehicles, and peppered with celebrities like acting legend Christopher Walken.
Nice ride.
It's the real deal. 100% electric.
It's the real deal.
Yeah.
But notably, the substance of EV ads has also shifted. No longer focused on the newness and novelty of EVs, but more on their coolness and usefulness, like the commercial that demonstrated an EV being used for electricity outdoors. Contrary to a recent surge in misleading media coverage that falsely suggests electric vehicle sales are down, in reality, sales of electric vehicles remain robust and growing in the U.S. and around the world. But the growth rate of sales dipped slightly in 2023 in the U.S. because it only increased 42% over the previous year. Detroit automakers GM and Ford say they have temporarily pulled back EV production while demand catches up. And in California, EVs now make up a quarter of all new cars sold.
One in every four new cars sold.
Finally, a jury in Washington, D.C. has awarded $1 million in damages to climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann, who sued two right-wing bloggers for defamation after they falsely accused him of manipulating data showing how our planet is dramatically warming, the famous hockey stick graph that has since been confirmed hundreds of times over. The jury found that falsely attacking climate scientists is not protected speech and is indeed defamatory. Here's Dr. Michael Mann on CNN.
Open debate is a good thing in our public discourse, in our scientific discourse. But it is not okay to make false accusations and defamatory accusations against scientists as part of an ideologically driven agenda.
No, it is not. And though it's taken years, it's great to see Mike stand up against these bullies.
Speech is free, but lies are going to cost you.
About $1 million. For much more on these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
And if I had $1 million, I'd buy your love.
There you go.
Yep.
We ain't got close to $1 million. But we're still available on your public airwaves. Thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on those public airwaves. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. My thanks, as ever, to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks, Des.
Yep.
And to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter. I am the Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
If I had $1 million, I'd be rich.